back to the Visions of a Better World podcast. Today we're continuing our discussion on democracy with Annina Leiviskä, Associate Professor in Education at the University of Oulu, and Tuija Kasa, a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Oulu in the Faculty of Education and Psychology. We were previously discussing the challenges facing democracy today, and now we will shift our focus to the future of democracy. So welcome back again, Annina and Tuija.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So in your view, what are the most pressing threats to democracy today? If these challenges remain unaddressed, how might they shape the future of democracy and global governments? And you can reflect on anything you'd like in the current times. Would Annina or Tuija like to begin?
Well, I can start. So we have already discussed polarization and the rise of anti-democratic and authoritarian forces and leaders. And these are essentially what I think the major risks for democratic societies today. We have a very alarming example from the past few months, what an authoritarian leadership in one of the most globally influential countries in the world can do to the entire global order. And similar developments are also taking place in European countries. I think there's a legitimate concern for the future of democracy as both a political and a moral or ethical project. And of course, we can hope that this is merely one phase in the world history, which will be preceded by many others, or at least another one in which liberal democracies kind of regain their strength. But the reality is that we don't really know for sure. So I guess we also need to prepare for the possibility that the kind of time for liberal democracies, at least in the sense that we have known them so far, is at least transforming, if not coming to an end. So we need to think about what might come next and how could we save some of the democratic core values and ideals in a sort of changed global order. I don't have any kind of clear or ready answers to these very difficult questions, but I think this is the situation where we are now.
Yeah, there are so many threats that it's, you could say so many things, but for me also rising authoritarianism, populism, polarization, spread of disinformation, divisive politics and rhetorics, something perhaps that connects to our Demopol project, which has been about democratic education and political polarization in the era of global crisis, is this also perhaps our fragmentation to these egoistic camps that are interested in only your own rights or own aspects in society. This connects to this broader trend of increasing trend to turn inwards from the global community, which is the rising of nationalism, in the sense that the populist rhetoric often gives you an answer that if we just turn to our own nation, then the problems go away, and we cannot kind of return from the globalization and the global interconnectedness that we are living today. So this is a big issue. How could we like organize our societies in a way that we consider the global interconnectedness but also can somehow support just systems and at the national level so that people feel that they have some kind of power to influence in their own environment and that their rights can be realized. So this is a really, really big question. Something that concerns me a lot is this kind of big trend of questioning of common values and principles, which is kind of, there are many good reasons why we are in pluralist and diverse societies thinking about many ways of addressing ethics, morality and values, and we need to think about pluralism. But we also, to cooperate in at global level, but also in democracies, we need some kind of shared principles. And even in academia and in this general discourse, many people are really suspicious for ethics or morality. And this is something that I'm really concerned as a background with philosophy and thinking about moral philosophy, that we should have more reflective discussion on what ethics and morality mean and what are ethical decisions in democracy and in politics, so that politics doesn't reduce to only this power battle where kind of ethics or moral principles is something that we even don't even try to strive to anymore because it's too complicated in our diverse society. So this can lead to the increase of identity politics or these kind of identity camps and withdrawing from these also ideal aspirations that we need as humans to work together and build better and just societies and global cooperation and communities. So yeah, this is something I have been thinking a lot during my PhD journey. And of course, in this one good aspect could be the emphasizing the importance of explicit human rights commitments. And for instance, if you think about climate change and climate catastrophe, we will need human rights deliberations to make climate justice realize and take into account marginalized people and those who don't have so much power. So yeah, maybe these kind of broader trends are something that concern me a lot.
Yeah, I was also about to mention global crises such as pandemics and global warming as the major warming as major threats to democracy. Because what we saw, for instance, during the COVID-19 pandemic was that at a time of crisis, anti-democratic ideologies easily kind of gain strength and momentum. And also with the environmental crisis, we will be seeing drastic changes in democratic societies all over the world, such as more flows of mass immigration, for instance, as the environmental crisis deepens. And this will, of course, present new types of challenges to democracies concerning how to address the rights and equality of residents who don't have full citizenship rights, for instance. So, in a sense, we are living in a time of great transitions in many, many different ways in regard to democracy.
Yes, so when we continue to look into the future and the future of democracy, for me, one interesting question is the question of could democracy be somehow evolved or improved or changed in a way that suits our modern times in a better way? So then what are your views on alternative approaches to democracy, such as epistocracy, deliberative democracy, or, for instance, citizens' councils? Could these models address some of the weaknesses in modern democratic systems, or do they instead risk creating new inequalities? And is there a way to incorporate, for instance, knowledge and expertise into decision-making without undermining political equality? And then ultimately, is democracy for you still the best framework for addressing the complex challenges of the modern world? So many large questions. Who would like to start? Would you, Anni, like to start, for instance?
Sure. Well, first of all, I don't really see that deliberative democracy or citizens' councils would be alternatives to democracy per se. If you talk about democracy in a kind of a very narrow sense as a formal democratic procedure-making system, then probably they are alternatives. But in a sense, I see democracy as a broader concept. So in addition to formal democratic processes and institutions, it also includes, for instance, the civil society, the broad public discussion, and according to some views, even the private sphere of society from which these public issues also arise. So I would like to think that we are already living in a deliberative democracy in this broad and systemic sense, because our democratic system is essentially a talk or discussion-based system in which decisions are reached and public opinions are formed through political dialogue, discussion, debate, and negotiation on both formal and informal forums. And then citizens' councils, I think, are a one form of practicing inclusive deliberation or enhancing citizens' representation in democratic processes that could be used within democracy. And especially, it has been presented as one model of deliberative, of enhancing deliberative qualities of democracy. So, and I personally see citizens' councils or citizens' assemblies as one good and productive way to increase possibilities of more direct citizenship or citizen participation in democracy. And there's also the benefit that in citizens' assemblies, we can, or the discussion can be moderated in a way that citizens can be provided background information, and also perhaps the deliberating group can be more representative of different, even, and also marginalized groups. And also many studies show that deliberation among diverse rather than homogeneous groups tends to provide better good quality decision making. So also the diversity aspects can be taken into account in this kind of initiatives. Would you, Tuija, like to comment something?
I think also those, like, yeah, I agree with you that I don't perhaps see deliberative democracy as an alternative, but of course the kind of improving the systems of deliberation and their inclusivity and everything, it's really important. And for instance, recently in education, there has been a lot of talk about like children's councils or youth councils or in society in general, that how could we reach certain groups that are often neglected, that these are really innovative and interesting approaches, and I agree that these different forms of citizens' councils are important initiatives. And of course, like in this sense, I tend to think align with again with Judith Sklar's this kind of non-ideal theory and emphasizing the non-ideal circumstances, that every formation of power or politics produces this kind of collateral damage in a way that it always perhaps raises new inequalities that we need to be really sensitive and to care about. That, for instance, also in schools, we have schools councils, which is an important part, but then they have been criticized that the most active already kind of in good positions, youth who want to be active and participate, they are in them. And then the kind of broader representation is not always or many times included. So we need to always kind of research and think and reflect in a long-term thinking that how different new innovations, what do they do better, and then what perhaps exclusions they include. But of course, it's really important to think about the many possibilities and new ways to make deliberation more broad.
What are your views on the specific idea of epistocracy, where we would have some requirements for those who make decisions in politics, or even those who can try to get to a position where they make decisions? What are your views on epistocracy? Does it present more risks than opportunities, or could it be used in some less strict way, for instance?
That's a very good and timely question. There's a lot of talk about epistocracy in theories of democracy currently, because especially the so-called post-truth condition has provoked many theorists of democracy to question the epistemic value of democracy, in a sense that whether political discussion and decision-making among lay citizens can actually produce good quality decisions. Is democracy, in a sense, a truth maker? Or should we question the epistemic benefits of democracy more rigorously? And some have even proposed that we should altogether reject the idea of democracy as an epistemically beneficial system and move to an some kind of a epistocratic system with experts in ruling political ruling positions. But I don't support the idea of epistocracy per se, because it compromises the kind of the moral ideal of democracy as representation of citizens' will. And at least for me, that compromise is too big to make. But I do agree that experts do and can play a central role in, or maybe not, maybe central role is a bad phrasing, but an important role in democratic decision making. And one possibility is that what is actually already happening in many democratic societies, to a certain degree also in Finland, that experts play this kind of a preparatory function where they provide the needed expertise, for instance, scientific knowledge, as a background information for political decision makers. One suggestion is that they could even organize or give to political decision makers or citizens a range of possible or available alternatives from which to kind of choose then on political basis, but that the alternatives would all be kind of plausible and rely on scientific knowledge and so on. So I think in this kind of a preparatory role and as a background support for political decision making, I think expert knowledge and especially scientific knowledge, of course, plays an important role. And not all decisions, for instance, concerning basic health precautions or something like that, can be decided based on political means, or at least based on purely political means. So I think what would be a good idea to do is to reject the kind of the strong opposition between expert knowledge and the rule by the people, and try to benefit from the knowledge provided by expertise while being mindful of the risks. Of course, experts can also be politically influenced, for instance.
Yeah, and I can. I need to first say that I'm not an expert of the theories of epistocracy. So, but in terms of thinking about the role of knowledge and science in democracy, I think it has become clear recently that healthy democracy needs. It is crucially connected to knowledge, research, science. This kind of reflected understanding of many things, and it's really dangerous if we detach from, for example, from research entirely, and if you think about if you take a concrete example like university policies, and if we have ministries and people who have a lot of power, and they don't have any kind of connection to how universities work and what is happening there, then it has been criticized a lot that the politics is going to wrong direction. So it is really important to listen to the this is of course important in every institution, that you need to listen to the people who work there and what are the kind of important aspects there, and how, for example, research is done and what is crucial for it. Just to use one example. So it's kind of, it cannot be just decided from the outside and so on. But always, of course, if you think about, like, there are also many threats and possible problems in the idea of prioritizing too much this epistemic ideal in practical sense. And something that comes first to my mind is Miranda Fricker's idea of epistemic injustice, which is really important to think about, like the questions of what kind of knowledge is perceived as valuable and what is excluded, and who is seen as an expert and so on. So in our non-ideal world, it's always connected to power struggles as well, that what kind of knowledge prioritizes. But of course, this doesn't reduce the importance of reflected, deeply done research or epistemic importance of many aspects. So yeah, it's tricky question, but perhaps we need to think about even more about these aspects, because with the spread of disinformation, and if the decisions are made on false premises, it's not a good direction for anyone. So it's democracy always needs structures where we respect also the research and science, for instance. But it requires always thinking how to organize this in a just way.
Yeah, there's already the practice of, for instance, in Finland, to invite researchers to these hearings by certain parliamentary groups. But then in these kinds of occasions, it's really important to pay attention that diverse or the diversity within science is represented, so that different kind of angles, for especially in the let's say economy, many theories within economy are themselves kind of politically laden or value laden, well, which of course applies to many other fields as well, but especially economical theories are often presented as these kinds of objective views about how the economy works, and that's not necessarily the case. So just what Tuija said about the importance of kind of understanding the power dynamics and also the diversity among different scientific views within the field, and that all a range of those views would be also then presented in political decision making, that's really important.
Yeah, and one example that came into my mind, that previously in Finland, for example, the fundamental and human rights experts and lawyers have been kind of having this position that they have been consulted about, is this according to human rights or constitutional rights? And the recent closure of Eastern border against all the legal advisors was a big kind of breach to the democratic trust or the kind of system that many people have been so much criticizing. It was a huge step backward in history to kind of just that the politicians disregarded all the expert statements. So yeah, it's a big problem for trust for democracy and for the people who work for these topics. So just to use one example, because there would have been options, and researchers have done work to look for options, but the politicians didn't listen, and they just disregarded the human rights commitments that Finland has. So yeah, it was a big bad thing that happened. Yeah.
What are your thoughts on the question of how democracy could or should be strengthened as a continuous process? Because the question of how should democracy evolve is, of course, really difficult, and it's impossible to give any definite answers. But then instead, I would argue that most people would agree that democracy should continuously be strengthened. So how could it be strengthened in your view? And could reforms like better civic education or fact-checking mechanisms or informed voting initiatives help address the current problems? Would you, Annina, for instance, like to start?
Well, of course, as a philosopher of education and as a representative of theory of democratic education, I see education as one of the key institutions and mechanisms to strengthen democracy. And I think democratic education in general should play a much stronger role in the education system than it currently does. The research on the Finnish context shows that both democratic and human rights education are carried out rather unsystematically. This is something that Tuija has especially discussed in her thesis, and also rather superficially in schools, and especially democratic education doesn't really offer young people genuine experiences of political or societal participation or influencing. So I think a lot remains to be done on that field to strengthen democracy. I think fact-checking mechanisms have been demonstrated to have some impact in reducing, for instance, the harmful effects of misinformation, but the impact is usually quite local and limited. And probably one of the reasons for this is that people don't necessarily accept fake news or misinformation because they lack knowledge or skills to distinguish facts from misinformation, but people tend to accept information that supports their prior beliefs and especially their political identities. So addressing the broader problem of especially effective polarization is of key importance in resisting, for instance, the influence of misinformation.
Yeah, and I agree with the importance of like explicit democratic and human rights education for everyone, that we should make sure that everyone has kind of a minimum education on these topics. But in general, I could also broaden that quality education in general is really important for democracy, because it's kind of it prevents, in best case, it makes citizens' abilities, improves their abilities to be against disinformation. So that's important. But again, the new modes of disinformation are so good that even people who are rehearsed might not. It's really hard to know what is true and fact anymore. So you need to be really like critical and reflective. So it requires so much from. So I support every kind of attempt to improve these kind of fact-checking mechanisms and everything, but I'm also really concerned about the spread of disinformation that is detached, as Annina said, from this kind of facts and knowledge that citizens should be interested in this, what is true, what is reflective, and so on, yeah.
But I, if I can shortly continue, I think the problem is also that there are these underlying mechanisms that are more influential than the rational capabilities that citizens have regarding, for instance, processing information and forming beliefs. But maybe this is something that we can discuss in regard to one of the forthcoming questions about citizens' democratic capabilities.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment actually on the role of course, these social media companies and how actually, especially with TikTok, we know that it feeds to young people certain type of content. And of course, now Meta and Twitter have lost. Before, when they used to have the warnings that this is disinformation, then we no longer have those. So I was thinking, is that something that's going, like, is there a way that should it be regulation of these companies that would then help to protect democracy and ensure that young people have a chance to actually get factual information? Because apparently, at least in the previous Finnish elections, then TikTok was the main source of political information for most young people, according to a certain poll. I just wanted to have your thoughts on that before you move to the next question.
Yes, I'm also very much in favor of these kinds of restrictions, especially on those platforms. What we are sadly seeing now, for instance, in the US, all of these fact-checking mechanisms have been removed from the social media platforms and among many other restrictions concerning the political content, for instance, that doesn't support the current administration. So evidently, these developments are very sad for democracy, and we should try to as much as we can in, for instance, European democracies, try to promote alternative and opposite practices, where we try to offer citizens as much correct information as possible, and especially. Of course, these platforms are really influential in regard to young people who perhaps don't have the societal or political awareness that maybe adult members of the society have.
Yeah, and that connects to the problem that there is so much happening in social media so quickly right now that, for instance, it's hard for schools to keep up with what is happening there. And recently, there has been a lot of discussion on, for example, how this kind of toxic masculinity and Andrew Tate and these influencers that affect young people a lot. And then many adults, teachers don't have any idea what is happening in the social media. They are not in TikTok, many of them. So it's kind of hard to even challenge these ideas. Many teachers might be really ill-equipped to have these conversations, going back to that we talked previously about that it's not easy to handle these controversial issues in education when young people raise some really illiberal ideas on so teachers also need to be prepared, and many are, but many are not, and it's easily silenced and not discussed enough, so because school would be a great place to discuss the facts and kind of challenge these ideas that are spreading. But right now we just witnessed the spreading and the kind of, I don't know the direction where is this going, but I hope we can try to keep up and increase the abilities to critically reflect what is happening there. And I hope that this is not the direction we will go, that the fact-checking is just going away and it's even like the spread of disinformation is even enhanced. And I can't believe that the people who have so much power that they decide to take this direction concerning the social media platforms. It's a bit unbelievable. Like, if we think about the threats that are in our hands. So I'm really, yeah, it's scary.
It is. Thank you.
One additional topic that, in my opinion, actually ties into everything we have discussed so far is, at least for me, the fact that in the end, society comes down to how we act as individuals and how we act as groups. And so we thought that it would be interesting to ask a few questions about this topic as well. So in your opinion, what is the relationship between the individual citizen and democracy? And when considering ways to improve society, what factors about human behavior and decision-making should be considered? And to what extent are individuals equipped to make informed collective decisions? And how might democratic systems support more thoughtful and productive civic engagement now and in the future? Would you, Tuija, for instance, like to start this time?
Yeah. I'm right now quite inspired by the Hanna Kuusela's book Syytös, which is in Finnish. But there's the main thread in the book is that we are the ones we have been waiting for, and I think this comes back to the idea that we should stop waiting for a savior in democracy, that someone else comes and saves us, but understand that we are all part of the system. So it comes back to, of course, to the individual citizen, that we are active and take part. But at the same time, of course, it can be really disheartening to be the only individual who tries to fight. So we need collective systems in democracy to also feel empowered and support each other. So for instance, when I discuss this with young people or children, it's important to think about ways to organize in communities or what kind of opportunities there is in NGOs or whatever is the individual's kind of preference for being part of democracy. It's not only being loud and going to the protests. That's one good way, but that's not the only. We should avoid these only stereotypical manners of representing democracy also, so that everyone can feel or find their own way to influence. You can write, you can do art, you can be part of social media community, you can support NGOs and so on. And concerning the kind of factors about human behavior and decision making, I recently have been thinking about and writing a lot about the idea that we should also consider the so-called dark side of humanity. Although we always need to like try to reach the ideals and goodness and values that make us like work together for a better world, but at the same time, when we think about practical aspects and our societies, it's really important to consider, for instance, humans' vulnerability to fear reactions that are now quite strong. For instance, that people are kind of attaching to some kind of for instance, traditional roles that are like give you security and the feeling of security. And it can be quite false sense in a way that you are then trying to diminish others' rights. For instance, in the anti-gender movement, that's a good example about that you want to kind of you fear that enhancing minorities' rights is going to collapse your right to feel that I'm a male or female. That's not the case, but it's just allowing different representations also to emerge. So we need to consider this, how to respond to the fears or how respond to ignorance or unwillingness to understand different aspects, because always it's not enough always to just increase knowledge. It's sometimes really strategic that people don't want to know about inequalities, or they want to hold on to their ignorance on racism or different aspects because they feel that it's somehow something away from them. So we need to consider these aspects really like in a reflective manner and get back behind these kind of somehow quite primitive reactions that we have as humans and fears and short sightedness that comes from the fears and that we don't want to think for a long run, because there's also so much even existential threats right now, like climate catastrophes and stuff like that. So how can we improve ways that people can get over these fears, for example? But please continue, Annina. I'll also think about more.
Yeah, I think my response also echoes what Tuija just said. So I think to consider human beings as and citizens as political decision makers, at least we should take into account some of the major political and epistemic limitations that people as actors have. And I have already mentioned some of them, including, well, Tuija here mentioned the kind of unwillingness to act in politically reciprocal manners, which is something that theories of democracy are often accused of, that they rely on these highly idealized views of citizens as reciprocal actors who are willing to consider their political views in light of the views and rights of others. And this, of course, especially in polarized societies, is very rarely the case. So citizens do not act on the basis of such citizenship virtues such as toleration or reciprocity anymore. And also, there are these epistemic limitations that we already touched upon. So people, at least it is argued in the studies that accepting false information is not so much a matter of people lacking certain cognitive skills or capacities or knowledge, rather than it is a matter of people processing knowledge and information in ways that supports their prior beliefs and their prior, especially their political and social attachments and memberships in a particular group. So this is something that is especially true in polarized, affectively polarized societies. So people can accept various kinds of false information and also values such as anti-democratic values purely based on their group membership and perhaps their group leaders, for instance. So it's not necessarily that people would kind of choose this type of value set, but it is risky for their social and political identity to depart from these views held within their political in-group. And that's what's the major, according to studies in political science, is the major motivating force driving people to these seemingly irrational decisions. And it's actually, many theorists argue that although they seem from the outside to be irrational, they are actually rational from the individual viewpoint as it is in their major interest is to remain an active and kind of included member within that group, political group, for instance, in which they belong. So these kinds of identity-driven motivations come in the way of reasonable decision making, for instance.
Thank you, everyone. I think now we've got our final question, and we're going to hopefully finish on a bit of a more hopeful tone. So I was going to ask, do you have any future visions of an ideal democratic system, even in 2050, for example? So we try to look further into the future, and what principles or structures do you believe would define a more just, effective, and inclusive democracy in the years to come? Would Tuija like to begin this time?
Yeah, thanks. Well, my first thought is that because human rights are being attacked, that we should at least not just abandon them, but trying to hold on to the system that we have been building after the World War II, and then improve the system in a way that if people feel that it's not effective enough and it's not like supporting us, we should bring or make them better in many ways. And I think that the ideal would be that people have a feeling of trust that they can influence and that they can trust the government and politicians. So this is also a kind of reminder for politicians that every false promise or empty talk is poison to democratic trust, because if people don't have that anymore, then democracy is in really big threat. So and we are witnessing this kind of mistrust for the kind of traditional systems, and then turning to these illiberal or populist or new ideas that can be really harmful, actually. So democratic system requires honesty and integrity from everyone, from the politicians and to the people. Again, I would emphasize the importance of intervening in inequalities in society and education. And so we will not achieve equality or inclusive democracy without willing to see the inequalities in the first place. And this requires proper education, awareness raising, and also measures to dismantle these inequalities. Yeah.
Well, we are again quite like-minded with Tuija. So, part of my vision for democracy is also increasing the inclusivity of democracy, especially by removing the barriers of political participation from those groups that have been excluded from much of social and political participation before. And I guess this means creating more effective mechanisms to intervene with such grave forms of inequality as racism and discrimination in different institutions and social contexts, including education. And also making society and politics more accessible by different means to those, for instance, have limited accessibility to information or for instance, limited Finnish language proficiency or something like that. So, eliminating inequalities and adding to the inclusiveness of democracy is definitely one of the key things that I would want to see happening. And also, I would like to see democracy as a more strongly representative system. Lack of adequate citizenship representation is one of the leading causes of citizens' lack of trust in democratic institutions and politicians. So different mechanisms and initiatives, including, for instance, citizens' assemblies, could be made in order to improve this situation. There has also been discussions about lowering the voting age for young people, but I think this is something that has to be carried out if it is in tandem with reforms in democratic and human rights education, so that people, young people, really understand the society and have some kind of experiences in participating in that political participation prior to being able to take a formal part in democratic decision making. And of course, something that can assist with this are the fact-checking mechanisms employed in different social media platforms and so on. And one thing is that I would like to mention is that I would really like to see democracy as a kind of a more future-oriented system, especially when we are facing these global threats, such as the environmental crisis. It would seem vital to consider not only current citizens, but also future citizens' views in some ways in making political decisions. I don't have any direct suggestions like what would be the exact mechanisms on how this could be done, but I would definitely like to somehow incorporate this kind of futuristic aspect into democratic decision-making more strongly.
Yeah, and something that came into my mind now that I'm maybe thinking a lot about this kind of defense struggle of democracy right now, because we are witnessing globally these attacks on civil society organizations and NGOs and cut of funds and everything. So it's really important to acknowledge these institutions' role in healthy democracy, that we have many institutions outside the official use of power who can be really open and critical and provide these kind of unofficial routes to activism and raise these kind of trouble spots in society in an open way. And that's a big, big problem globally right now, that it's the possibilities are diminishing all the time, and also here in Finland. So people need to be aware of the important aspects of healthy democracy and criticism and opportunities for resistance and holding the use of power accountable. So kind of understanding the bigger picture and the importance of defending democracy's different aspects of healthy and equal democracy is really, really important. And then if I come back to the idea of that we need to stop waiting for a savior, but of course also work in communities and do it together, because so that individual can easily kind of burn out if they try to change the whole world. We need each other for the changes. But something I have also been inspired is this idea of kind of ordinary people, that we don't also need only these kind of moral exemplars, because these can be really good and inspiring, but like maybe we need more stories and narratives of kind of basic people and ordinary people being part of the change and importance of this kind of everyday life, and this how democracy can be crumbled in this really small everyday steps and aspects, and then it can be too late when things go too far. So yeah, we definitely need new ways to think and talk about these issues.
Thank you. I just wanted to comment quickly actually on both of what you said. So one thing is, of course, this awareness of the democratic system and the freedoms that we have, because we won't be aware of them disappearing until they're gone. So that's a big key of actually the future, the current generations, and then being able to understand all the freedoms that we have, for example, in a place like Finland, and how they can degrade slowly. But also I was thinking on this future-proofing idea, then of course I think in future studies they have these ideas like in lawmaking, that laws are made now that are to protect future generations or for the environment, etc. I guess even the climate crisis is a good example of that. We're doing this to protect the future generations of the planet. So it's a very future way of thinking about democracy and society as a whole. But do you have any comments that you would like to say, Max?
Well, no, I'm really happy with these episodes. It was really interesting and lots of interesting topics covered and ideas presented. And let's continue the discussion inside our association with future events and podcasts. And democracy is, of course, a theme that touches upon almost anything, everything we discuss and bring up. So this is a really key point for us. And so we are really happy that we had these discussions with you and that they were this interesting. So.
Yes, thanks for inviting us. It was a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thank you for organizing interesting questions and discussion.
Okay, well, thank you so much. I think we'll conclude the episode now.
Thank you.
Thank you.